What is the trade that cost Warren Buffett the most amount of money ever? And it's a big number. And it's very interesting to study this trade, to break it down, to understand how Warren Buffett's style has changed over time. And I've written a book about Warren Buffett. It's called Trade Like Warren Buffett. I do think Warren Buffett is the best investor of all time. I follow everything he does. Whether you agree with him or not on different issues or different stocks, doesn't matter. The guy has been investing for over 70 years. He's been obsessed with it for 70 years, 7 days a week. And it's really good to learn his lessons. Trung Phan, who's been on the podcast before, he has broken down completely from beginning to end Warren Buffett's worst trade ever. And Trung and I talk about it.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show.
Trung Phan, welcome back to the podcast to talk about Warren Buffett.
Yes, number three.
Yeah, number three. And Warren Buffett being one of my favorite topics, the best investor ever. I wrote a book that no one ever remembers anymore. It's called Trade Like Warren Buffett. It's the worst cover in the world. Your newsletter that you sent out about Buffett reminded me a little of what I write about in my book, because the book's titled Trade Like. Warren Buffett used to be much more of a seller of stocks than people realize. He wasn't a buy and hold forever kind of guy, particularly in the 60s when you discuss his first investment in Disney. So what got you interested in this?
92nd birthday. And you know how it is with his birthday, right? Every year it's just like, here's 92 things Buffett said for his 92nd birthday. Last year was 91 things he said for his 91st birthday. And I actually hadn't heard much about the Disney trade. I knew he had owned Disney, but I started just Googling around it, come up during these kind of celebrations. Like, oh, you know, here, everybody's talking about all the wins he has. What about the misses? And I'm like, oh, Disney. And then I looked at him like, he owned 5% of Disney and he bought it for $4 million in 1966. This is wild. So the story is, I don't know how familiar the audience might be with the story, because this is much less popular and in mind share than many of his other great trades. Obviously, because this seems like more of an L. But in 1966, in the Buffett partnership, so this is before a transition to Berkshire Hathaway, Buffett partnership, to your knowledge, that's more of a friend and family's kind of vehicle where he just raised from his friends and family?
Yeah, I mean, it started off as a bunch of individual partnerships. Okay. Like he'd have his next door neighbor and he would just invest for that neighbor. And at the same time, he'd invest for other people in different accounts. But then he combined them all together in the early 60s into essentially a hedge fund structure where he took a percent after a certain point. I forget the exact fee structure, but after a certain point of profits, he would take something like 15 or 20% of the profits. I forget exact fee structure, but he would take a percentage of the profits after the profits hit a certain point. And this is really how he made his first $1 million, was off these fee structures like that.
And this is the period, as you describe in your book. So I actually haven't read that book, but you sent it to me and I read the reviews of it. And I guess your book's describing this period in the 60s where he's basically running essentially this hedge fund, right?
Yeah, it was before Berkshire Hathaway, where he started publicizing with his letters every one of his investments. They weren't really so public then what he was doing. Right. And he would write individual letters to investors, which I did get a hold of. And that's how I wrote the book. But it was really fascinating to see his kind of progress as an investor, because that was where he made his biggest leap intellectually, I think, as an investor.
Okay, so I'd love for you to tease that part out after I just finished on the Disney thing. So the Disney investment is obviously so interesting because it's one that's lasted since 66 until now, and it's now a $200 billion company, massive mindshare in the public. But at the time when he invested, and this isn't adjusted for inflation, but just to give a scale, it was $80 million market cap was his investment, right? What I found so interesting about the story is he actually went to see Walt Disney. So Warren Buffett was 35 years old.
I didn't know that until I read your newsletter.
Yeah, so Warren Buffett was recounting this story of visiting Walt Disney. So he went to Notre Dame's MBA school in 1991 and was kind of going through his old trades. And somebody asked him about Disney. He's like, yeah, I went to go see Walt Disney. And Walt Disney had no idea who I was. Walt Disney had no reason to know who he was, right? Just ran this small hedge fund out of Omaha. But he visited Walt Disney, and Walt was apparently in this meeting extremely gregarious and explained to him his kind of like, you know, that famous like Walt Disney business model chart. He was like explaining all those things. And he basically recalls that Walt was like, yeah, we have all these assets, including these films like Fantasia, Snow White, 200 other like classic films on our books, those assets have a value of $0. Like, there was no idea of the intellectual property that would continue forward as a stock analysis. So Buffett's like, wait a second, you're telling me that all these movies you have, all this IP is worth zero on your books? So that to him blew his mind. And his line was basically, the IP that Disney has is like an oil well that replenishes oil like every 7 years, because the next generation of kids will just ask their parents to go watch Mary Poppins or Snow White and the Seven Dwarves. So that to him was already worth more than the 80 million market cap.
I mean, that's fascinating if you think about it, because A, I'm wondering what their total assets were at that time. Was it 80 million and Buffett thought he was buying at a discount to the total assets? And then you have this added benefit of Mary Poppins and Sleeping Beauty and all that generate ongoing money. Also, nowadays, movie studios are more like a hit factory where they don't really, the long tail isn't as big because there's so much competition for content. I mean, now you have movies made by Netflix, Amazon, Apple, all the studios, indies, and so on. Whereas Disney was the only player for like kids' animated movies at that time.
Exactly. So the fact that the market wasn't really considering that IP like a real asset, so that blew Buffett away. And to your question, it's like, did they have like 80 million of assets on the book? Well, they just built the Pirates of the Caribbean rides in like 1965, and that cost $17 million. And so Buffett joked at a later general meeting in the 90s that he couldn't believe that he found a company trading for 5x theme park ride, because it's like $80 million company. Pirates of the Caribbean costs $17 million. And then he did the math on the theme park in 65. It had 11 million visitors to Disneyland, paying about $7 each. So just the revenue from Disneyland box office ticket was the same as $80 million. He's like, I'm getting everything for free and Walt Disney. And he's like, this is like the greatest deal ever.
That's interesting because the reason why that's important is like this period in Buffett's investment life was divided into two parts. One is what he called cigar butt stocks. And that was really from his mentor, Ben Graham, who wrote, the classic text, The Intelligent Investor. He also wrote classic text, Security Analysis. And Buffett had interned for him in the early 50s and also studied with him at Columbia University. And the only reason Buffett didn't continue working for Ben Graham is Ben Graham was one of the few Jewish firms on Wall Street. And because many of the other firms wouldn't hire Jews, Ben Graham would only hire Jews. So even though Buffett was such a great employee for him, he couldn't hire Buffett full time. So Buffett moved back to Omaha and started essentially his Buffett partnerships.
I did not know that. That is some like sliding door history, right? Like how different it could have been.
But Ben Graham, he grew up as an investor in the Depression, where so many stocks traded below their liquidation value. Like if you have $100 in your wallet, but you could buy it for $80, of course you would buy it for $80. And those were the only stocks that Buffett would look at, particularly in the 50s and the very early 60s. And he would go through thousands of earnings reports. He would find companies that were worth $100, but you could buy for $80, metaphorically. And he would literally, a lot of these companies wouldn't trade very well on the stock exchange. They had no liquidity. So he would go to those towns where the companies were based and put up signs and say, if you have shares of this company, I'm in this hotel, please sell them to me. And that's how he really made, his first profits from his hedge fund, is he only going for those types of stocks. But then in 1962, when he started hanging out with Charlie Munger, he realized there was some value to a brand. So like American Express was going through a big scandal, and Buffett realized their brand had value, not just the cash they had in the bank or their what their assets would be if they liquidated, but their brand had value too. And this was Charlie Munger's influence on him. So he started getting a lot more involved in companies like American Express, where there was sort of this unquantifiable brand value. And so I was just curious with Disney, if he was looking at brand or assets. But it sounds like he's looking at a little bit of mixture, like the brand of Mary Poppins, which had just come out in 1965, was going to be this ongoing source of cash flow because it was so strong.
Oh, that's exactly right. And I did not know about that Charlie Munger influence either. So this is great. I'm learning so much about this early 60s Buffett. And it makes a lot of sense, right? Because he did come from the Graham School of Value Investing. And I don't want to bury the lead here. Like the purpose of why I wrote the Disney articles, because I think this is his biggest stock miss. And I should have said that at the very top. And we can discuss some of his other misses over the decades. But the reason why I think it's the biggest miss is we just kind of talked about it. He had identified his thesis on this was, okay, the IP, extremely valuable, will keep renewing every 7 years. And the theme park, this real life physical asset, extremely valuable. And he'd spoken to Walt Disney. Like, he understood the long-term thesis for Disney. And then a year later, he sold for, 50% gain, right? So invested $4 million, sold it for $6 million, but a year later. And well, I'd like to ask you this so obviously he's famously said, my favorite holding period is forever. But when did he actually transition to that type of investor? Because I don't think it's fair for me to knock 1966 Warren Buffett for selling at a 50% gain a year later when he probably wasn't that type of individual that was like, I'm just going to hold forever. Like, when did that transition happen?
Yeah, I mean, and that transition wasn't then. Like, he again, with these cigar butt stocks, if they became valued more than their liquidation value, he would be more interested in selling because that was his style. And also, he was managing other people's money, so he was a little more sensitive to their risks. But I would say that started happening around the 80s because he started to get so big. He put it this way. There's two scenarios. One is he's telling the truth, and one is he's lying when he says his favorite holding period is forever. The way he might be lying, or at least being a little misrepresenting, is because he wants your holding period to be forever because he's so big. He can't move out of a stock in a day. Like, we're more nimble than him. We have advantages.
He needs the permanent capital, right? He needs you to believe in him and that kind of permanent capital mindset. It's like, we're just going to trust you with this.
Right. Otherwise, everybody will rush out of a stock before he gets a chance to rush out of a stock. So he's so big, he can't like move in and out of a stock. I mean, he invests hundreds of billions of dollars now. But I would say in general, that's a true statement for him right now. Like, he'd rather not sell anything. If something's... Another statement that he makes that I like is that if a company is going to be around 20 years from now, it's probably a good investment now. So with that in mind, every good company is always a good investment, and he'd rather stick in the good investments because there's few places for him to put that much money. But I would say it wasn't until the 80s that he started really feeling that way. And by the way, he had a personal portfolio that he would manage up until the early 00s where he was buying and selling the cigar butt stock style, the Ben Graham style, all the way up until the early 00s, and then he stopped doing that. But just out of his, because he never sold a single share of Berkshire Hathaway stock. So just out of his personal money, he built that up to $100 million or more.
Whoa.
You know, just trading these cigar butt stocks whenever they would appear. And he was definitely an active trader of those. But for Berkshire Hathaway, he's definitely buy and sell forever. The other thing is I just want to mention is that he was also winding down at some point his Buffett partnerships. So they stopped, I think in 1969 was the end of them, or maybe 1968. I forget the exact year.
That's when they acquired Berkshire Hathaway as the textile manufacturer, right? And then just became a holding company.
Yeah. So what happened is that first, it's funny about Berkshire Hathaway. So whenever Berkshire Hathaway was trading below its liquidation value, he would buy up shares and then he would say to the CEO, listen, you should do a stock buyback at X, you know, at a certain price. So he'd buy up shares at $6 and he would say to the CEO, listen, it's worth $7. You should do a share buyback. And the CEO would usually say, yeah, sure, you're right. And then there was one time the CEO said, yeah, you know, I don't think I'm going to do that. I think I'm going to buy back at $5. And Buffett had bought at $6. I'm making up the numbers a little, but they're sort of correct. And Buffett's like, nah, you need to buy them back at $7 or $8. And the CEO's like, nah, not this time, Warren. And so Warren Buffett bought up 51% of the company, fired the CEO, and became the CEO and took over Berkshire Hathaway. And so that's a little known fact about how he took control of Berkshire Hathaway. And then he thought a recession was going to come in the 70s, which it did. And so he got rid of his partnerships and gave everybody the choice. Either go with some friends of mine who are good value investors or stick with me and become shareholders of Berkshire Hathaway. And so he shut down all the Buffett partnerships. So it could be related to that too, that he didn't really hold any of his holdings into Berkshire Hathaway, as far as I know. From, you know, then he started reinvesting and building up Berkshire Hathaway.
Right. That's a very fair point. And I kind of hinged the entire argument, it could be flimsy, on the fact that he later said that selling was a huge mistake, as in maybe he felt that there was a way that, obviously hindsight's 2020, but I'm wondering if he's like, oh, there could have been a world where I, you know, kept buying it or reacquired it under $200 million market cap. But the other thing about that period, which is to your point, another reason he might have also sold is Walt Disney died in 1966. So if he's talking about the architect of this business model, but the hedge I have with that is that he knew how valuable that IP was, and the theme park, I feel like at that point it was kind of like a machine, although the Disney kind of filmed in the 70s were awful. So maybe he was making the right move. But that kind of brings us to the next part, right? And you mentioned American Express. So he bought and sold American Express as part of Buffett Partnership. I think he did 5X on that over 5 years. You probably know the numbers better than I do.
Yeah, some huge amount. I mean, definitely that was the biggest source of gains for his funds at that point.
Right. And then, so what's interesting about Amex is he bought back in the early 90s, right? So there was like this parallel world where we're looking in the 60s where there's these two, today they're considered blue chips, Amex and Disney. Buffett owned both of them in the 60s, sold out of both positions, but then rebuilt Amex intentionally in the early 90s. So he's rebuilding Amex, and the Disney thesis is still sitting there. And Disney's having a great run in the early 90s. They just did Lion King, Aladdin. This is when Eisner was crushing it before a bit of his downfall. But Buffett comes into 3.6% of Disney in 1996, when Disney acquires Capital Cities / ABC, the ABC network, but mainly now they own ESPN, which is the big thing.
What year did Disney buy ABC? What year did Disney?
So Capital Cities acquired ABC, merged with ABC in 1985, and Buffett helped finance that. So he was the largest shareholders in Capital Cities / ABC.
And just some context there. So Buffett really loved this one guy, Frank Murphy, who he started off owning like a TV station in, I think it was in New York, and then he bought a bunch of radio stations, and he just became a very good acquirer and operator of media properties. And then for whatever reason, in 1985, ABC was having some problems. Capital Cities was able to buy ABC, and I guess Buffett went in full force into Cap Cities, and that was his big play, like that. And then Disney acquired Cap Cities / ABC / ESPN in 1995 or 1996.
Yeah, the deal closed in 96. And the other part of this deal that I loved, and I wrote about it in the article, was that it kind of came together because of Buffett, just completely randomly. He was hanging out at the Sun Valley, Idaho media conference in Idaho. Have you ever been to Sun Valley?
No, I never have. I wanted to go one year and I wasn't invited. I pushed for it, but it didn't happen.
Yeah. So Buffett is kind of walking around Sun Valley. He's about to go golf with Murphy, who you just talked about, the CEO of Capital Cities. He bumps into Michael Eisner, the CEO of Disney. And then they just start talking shop. And Buffett's like, hey, I'm about to go see Murph. We're going to go hit the links. Do you just want to go chat? And so the three of them just, because they bumped into each other, they had already floated the idea of a merger acquisition over the years, but it just so happened this was the ultimate catalyst that led to the 1996 $19 billion Disney acquisition of Capital Cities, which at the time was either the second or third largest MMA deal in U.S. history. Number one was the Nabisco, whatever the Barbarian of the Gates deal was, and the cigarette deal. But I just love that little anecdote that he kind of had the part in making this deal happen and then walks away with 3.6% of Disney because he was Capital City's largest shareholder. And he held it for more or less 5 years. And then in my mind, I'm like, oh, here he is. He gets another bite at the apple. But within 5 years, he sells the entire Disney position. And the long-term thesis for Disney, again, hadn't really changed. It was like IP and theme park. And in the middle, in the 30 years since his first ownership of Disney, they had gone way more IP. And then he still ditched it.
I think Buffett gets nervous whenever a story starts to fall apart. So when Michael Eisner was like going heavily into internet properties, like Buffett really hated the internet in the 90s, but Eisner was going like headfirst into internet stuff. Then Buffett made, then Eisner made Michael Ovitz the president of the company, and Buffett didn't like that. But Buffett really loved Bob Iger, who was running ABC and was originally a Cap Cities guy. And now Bob Iger is the CEO of Disney, or he was the CEO of Disney. I think he just left, or I forget. But Buffett loved Bob Iger. If he knew Bob Iger was eventually going to run Disney, he probably never would have sold. But I think he lost complete faith in Michael Eisner.
Well, that, you nailed, I think, the transition there, because it was Iger who really became Mr. IP, right? Pixar, Marvel, Fox, yeah. All these acquisitions were under Iger. And to your point, Michael Eisner, oh no, sorry, under Iger. So Eisner did two things in the late 90s in addition to the internet. So Buffett hated internet. They bought InfoSeek. Disney did. So Buffett was probably like, ugh, that's not my favorite acquisition.
Yeah.
He spent $1.7 billion on InfoSeek, the search portal. And then you mentioned Michael Ovitz. But the other two things that were interesting, and it goes back to Buffett's thesis, was the theme parks were a disaster. So I was not old enough to remember this, so I'd love to pass the baton to you, not to suggest you're much older than me. But Euro Disney launched in 1992 in Paris, complete disaster.
Yeah, it was a total failure. And same
with
Asia.
Do you remember that? Like, what were like, what were people saying at the time?
They were saying it was empty. It opened up and here it cost billions and billions of dollars to make and it was empty. So there was real questions about Disney's viability as a company at that time.
Yep.
Like,
well, the interesting thing about the Paris one, and I love your thoughts on this, is so I've been to Tokyo, Disney Tokyo, and it's amazing. And that makes sense though, because the local Japanese population, they kind of love going into these theme parks and different cartoony, Hello Kitty's huge in Japan too. But the Paris one, you mentioned they spent billions of dollars to build like six massive hotels on the property, but you're competing with the number one tourist city in the world that has the Louvre and the Eiffel Tower like right there, right? So nobody's going to spend a week in a hotel inside Disney Paris. They're going to probably just spend a day there max as a site. So that was, I think, the huge miscalculation.
Yeah, and Buffett always says his biggest mistakes are the things he didn't do. And like, obviously, he should have kept holding on to Disney. And again, I think if the bridge was Bob Iger, he would have done it. Like if he knew Bob Iger was going to be the successor to Eisner, he would have stayed in. Because he, you know, Frank Murphy, he trusted Frank Murphy so much. Frank Murphy became a board member until he died of Berkshire Hathaway. So Buffett really sticks with his partners. And Frank Murphy, he at Capital Cities / ABC, he really liked. Michael Eisner, maybe not as much, particularly in Eisner's later days. And, you know, and again, this reminds me of Coca-Cola. So Coca-Cola, Buffett always loved it as a company, but he wouldn't buy into it because they started a clothing company. They started investing in movie. I think they own Columbia Pictures, so they started investing in movies. The story was not consistent, and the stock started to fall apart. And it was only then that he took a major stake in Coca-Cola, because then it started to trade below what he thought was its asset plus brand value, because the brand had diluted so much. And, you know, Disney in the late 90s would not have been a great Buffett story.
Yeah, could you explain more about his interest with Iger? Like, what was Iger's reputation at ABC and Capital Cities in the 90s?
It was great because, the whole Frank Murphy school of thought was very similar to Buffett's, which is that buy properties really cheap. I mean, they bought ESPN. I think you mentioned in your newsletter, they bought ESPN for something like $188 million. And this is like now probably a $20 billion property. And Iger and Murphy always operated really well, cut costs, bought things cheap. So it was very much in Buffett's style of thinking. And so he was very confident owning Cap Cities forever. And of course, Disney paid a nice premium for it. Buffett ended up doing very well and, you know, made a lot of money. But again, Iger was sort of an intellectual descendant of Frank Murphy, who was very similar to Buffett in terms of his thinking about how to acquire and operate things. And Iger, ran ABC, the television channel. So, he knew, Iger was from the Cap City side.
The more I'm like kind of talking with you through the two Disney, the transactions he had, and the more you're giving the context, it makes a lot more sense now why he doesn't own 8.6% of Disney, right? Which is also, totally forgot to mention, is like if he had, between these two deals, the 8.6%, totally hypothetical, if he had held on to those two stakes, would be worth $18 billion, which would be the sixth largest Berkshire position. I did a really crude equal weighted analysis, but that's like 34 times the initial investment, which is comparable to, better than Coca-Cola and American Express, but not time weighted. Coca-Cola, he invested at a cost basis of $1.3 billion. That's a $25 billion position now, so 19 times. Amex, the one that you mentioned, when he re-went in the early 90s, he now owns 20% of Amex, which is mind-boggling. Cost basis, about $1.3 billion, and that's worth $23 billion. So like, that's how good the Coca-Cola full deal would have been in a totally hypothetical world.
Yeah, and like I guess it's to his point too that he doesn't mind buying late. Like American Express, he owned it in 1962 and eventually sold it, but he's able to buy back later because the company still keeps growing and he knows it's going to be around 20 years from now. I think another one where he did that was Geico. He was in and out of Geico a bunch of times until finally Berkshire Hathaway essentially bought Geico, the whole company. And Geico was a company he liked even as a little kid. Like, he holds on to his interests for a long time. Like, when he was a teenager, I think it was, he visited Geico headquarters like on a holiday and kept knocking on the windows until someone answered. And it was the CFO of the company who later became CEO. And he learned everything about the insurance business from this guy that day. And I mean, here's an interesting thing about Buffett. Buffett started out running these hedge fund-like structures, but he realized there's a better way to make money. And so what's a hedge fund? A hedge fund basically takes in investor money. They take a small management fee. Like let's say you take in $100 million. Maybe you take $1 million or $2 million as a management fee per year. And then the typical hedge fund takes 20% of profits. So if they return 10%, so 10 million, and you take 20% of profits, you make another 2 million. So you would make maybe 3 or 4 million altogether running a hedge fund. He decided much better were banks. So in the mid-60s, he started buying small regional banks. Now, what does a bank do? The investors basically give the bank money, but they only expect back their savings account interest. So like right now, it'd be like less than 1%. Back then, I don't know what it was. And the bank essentially then lends out the investor money to other people who want to buy homes. And then the bank let's say they borrow from people at 1%, but they lend out at 6%, the bank makes the 5% difference. So he said that's a much better business model because it's much more scalable than a hedge fund. You're not constantly trying to raise money and you don't have to sweat too much for the profits. You're just lending out to people who buy homes. And then he decided even better than banks is insurance companies. The best way to make money, he felt, and he's correct, is owning an insurance company, because then quote unquote investors give you money, but they never want the money back. Like when you give an insurance company money, like you personally, you never want that money back because it means you're sick or your car crashed or you died or whatever. And so, but still the insurance company gets to invest all the money and they hopefully never give any of the money back. And what typically happens is they break even, like they have to give some money back because people get into car crashes. So they try. So Buffett's very good at managing how to make a profit on the insurance side. And then he makes an enormous profit on the investing side and he gets to keep 100% of the profits. Like he doesn't have to share any of the profits with the people who buy insurance. So that's why Berkshire Hathaway, ultimately, he knew this was going to happen when he switched from hedge funds to Berkshire Hathaway. He knew it was ultimately going to be an insurance company.
Well, the money, I'm sure most of your listeners will know, but the premiums that he gets from the customers, insurance customers, obviously that's called float, right? That's the money that is supposed to be held for future liabilities. And to your point, is like the expectation is that if you can manage those by investing like very conservatively in like, treasuries or you want to make sure that the money's there for any future claims. But to your point, Buffett's such a great investor that not only was he getting to hold this float for quote unquote free, he's getting paid to hold it because he was investing so well with it. And I guess everybody's been trying to recreate the model. And I think Buffett has called the float like the eighth wonder of the world. It's just whatever he's doing with it has built this empire. That's very fascinating, the transition and how much it kind of changed his mindset. But I wanted to go back to something that you mentioned about Buffett not being afraid to go back into a position or buy, quote unquote, late. I think Apple's the best example of this, right? He was tech averse his entire career. He never invested in Microsoft, even though he was really good friends with Bill Gates through the late 90s. He never invested in Amazon, Google, Facebook. He also didn't really regret not investing in like Amazon or Microsoft because he said he's never understood the business models and he wanted to be in his circle of competence, which him and Charlie Munger like to talk about. The Google one is interesting actually, and it goes back to your insurance point because he looked back and said, we missed on Google. And the reason we missed, even though it's a technology company, we knew their business model because Geico was spending $10 a click to be on the first page of Google search ranking. So he's like, if we're like, that was kind of like, he was one of the biggest customers, right? He's yeah. like, this is such a great business model. And he's like, that's one technology company that I actually do regret not investing in because the business model was just so simple. And, but back to Apple. So it doesn't invest in Apple till 2016. Ted Wexler, one of the two, portfolio managers he brought in, Todd Combs, Ted Wexler, basically he brought an investment case to Buffett that is in Buffett's wheelhouse. Apple has a monopoly. Its monopoly is around the App Store and the its operating system, right? And he's like, okay, I get this. And Apple realistically is a consumer product and Buffett understands consumer, understands brand. So this all goes back to your original point. Like, he's not afraid to go back into something quote unquote late, but when he does, will also do it with a massive cannon. So I am just fully convinced that his $32 billion Apple bet in 2016, which is now worth about $150 billion, it doesn't even include the dividends, is the greatest like public market tech bet ever, just on a pure dollar scale, right? He's made on paper $120 billion on Apple, owns more than 5% of the company.
And this is another thing he realized from Charlie Munger, and this was in the 1962 American Express bet. He's willing to go in super big, like a normal hedge fund is going to have like 100 positions and, you know, try not to have any position more than 1% of the portfolio. But American Express became like 30 or 40% or more of his portfolio at the time. Like, he was taking a big risk. And in 1962, American Express seemed like on the verge of going out of business because of a scandal that was happening. And so but he realized the brand would overcome the scandal. So he stayed in. But when he has high conviction now, I mean, he says, imagine investing is like you have a punch card with 10 potential holes, and every time you make an investment, you have to click one of the holes. So you only have 10 investments you can make in your life. And that's how he sort of views it now and why he's willing to bet super huge.
Well, so I just want to say something you said from the very beginning was, and there just aren't that many things he can do at that stage now, right? That's why actually a lot of his, if you look at the past decade, he's had a number of not great investments like Precision Cash Parts. I think that's $30 billion. Kraft Heinz, I think he put in over $20 billion into that deal. There's just not many deals he can do now with a $150 billion cash pile, which is why Apple was just such an amazing, like opportune time. It's like, if you were to stick in the year 2016 and you had to put $30 billion somewhere and wanted to 4X, like it had to be Fang, right? And then he basically had to pick the one that he understood the most.
Yeah, and Apple was always interesting in that, unlike Google and some of these other companies, Apple always traded at a low multiple of earnings. So if a company makes like a dollar and it trades for $20, then it's considered it trades for 20 times earnings. So Apple always trades, like, let me see right now. I mean, even right now, it trades for about 24 times earnings, which is high for Apple. But, you know, so it's almost like, it almost would be too expensive for Buffett now. But back then in 2016, I think it was trading for more like less than 10 times earnings.
Right. Less than S&P, I think, is because people are like, oh, the iPhone cycle is done. This is a hardware company. It has no software advantage. It's like all these kind of like bearish theses, which, you know, in hindsight, are just so wrong. It's like the brand of Apple is the greatest luxury product, mass luxury product ever.
I mean, even in 2010, I remember looking at Apple, and this was, you know, shortly after Steve Jobs passed away, it was only trading for like 5 or 6 times earnings. It was trading for definitely less than 10 times earnings. And Apple was always relatively cheap compared to other tech companies. So it makes sense that that was the one that Buffett bought because it has such a strong moat. Now, but you mentioned in your newsletter, you mentioned that you interviewed Stanley Druckenmiller, who also thought Google was like the best company ever. And Druckenmiller is famous as one of Soros' top traders. And then he started his own hedge fund and became one of the biggest hedge funds in the world. Like, what was that? How did you get an interview with Druckenmiller?
Oh, so that was May 2021. I was kind of profiling a company, a fintech company he had invested in. It's called Toggle AI. And they had kind of set me up with Stan to discuss mostly just about his career, but also just why he made that investment. But I think this goes back to Buffett's rationale for missing Google. Why he actually does kind of regret it is Stanley Druckenmiller is not like a super, he invests across all asset classes and he's not like a tech focused guy. And famously he invested $6 billion like hours away from the top of the dot-com bubble and lost $3 billion within weeks, right? So like, he's taken huge losses in tech. But yeah, I asked him about, hey, if you were to look at the FANG companies, this is May 2021, and Microsoft, like which one do you think will hit $5 trillion first? And then he's like, listen, this is totally guessing. I'm not going to prognosticate here, but if you had to put a gun to my head, I'd say Amazon would be first. And then he said Microsoft would be second. He says, I don't actually believe in Apple's ability to innovate for the new economy. And then the 2-line iPhone that he did not put them in the bucket. But he said, if Google was broken up and they weren't bundling all these random moonshots they're taking with Google X, he's like, if that standalone business was the core search business was its own company, he's like, that could be a wild card, because he said this is literally the greatest business model I'd ever seen, and it's simple. It's such a simple business model, and that's why I think Buffett does regret missing that.
Yeah, that's interesting. And you know, in the early 00s, he started to loosen up a little bit. Like I know he lent Amazon a bunch of money and he got some stock for that. So he started to structure more deals with tech, but and get more comfortable with it. But you know what the classic Buffett deal is now? Like Buffett has such a strong name that he basically goes up to a company, like he did this during the financial crisis, a classic example, but he did this for the past 30 years. He has such a strong name. He'll go up to a company like Goldman Sachs and say, look, I want to invest. And Goldman Sachs might say, okay, well, we trade on the stock market, knock yourself out. And Buffett's like, no. I want to invest with you. Like, I'm going to give you money directly. And they're like, oh, okay. Well, I guess it's great to have Warren Buffett as an investor. So we'll take your money. Our stock's selling for whatever, $100 a share. And then Buffett's like, no. I like your stock if it's $80 a share. So Goldman Sachs or whoever will say, okay, we'll sell you stock personally at $80 a share, even though it trades for $100. And that'll be a great deal. And Buffett's like, no. I need a little bit more than that. I need a 9% dividend. And they'd be like, well, Warren, dividends are like 1% right now. I want a 9% dividend. And they'll give it to him. And that's the typical Warren Buffett deal now.
Don't forget the warrants either. He's like, and I also want warrants to buy shares at a 30% discount from the price that I choose.
Yeah, right. Like also for free, I want the option to buy double the stock at $50 a share.
Well, that's how he built his second biggest position, is just Bank of America. Same deal from the financial crisis. I think he invested $3 or $5 billion, got a 10%, just preferred shares with a 10% dividend, and then warrants to buy whatever price. But so his cost basis on Bank of America is $14 billion. That position is now $35 billion. So absolute doll. I mean, just what a, he did the same with GE. So GE, Bank of America, and Goldman, he told AIG to go kick rocks when he looked at their books. Same with Lehman's. Yeah. He's like, this is just all garbage. But he's like, to your point about the brand stuff, you mentioned the brand stuff. He's like, I think he said specifically like, this Goldman brand is the best brand in finance. He's like, I get to buy this and I get to give all the terms that you mentioned. Like, of course I'm going to do it.
Yeah. And his point was, look, if capitalism's falling apart, we have more things to worry about. But if capitalism doesn't fall apart, Goldman Sachs is going to survive. I mean, Hank Paulson was the Secretary of Treasury at the time, who was the ex-CEO of Goldman. Like, Goldman was not going to fall apart. It was this probably the safest investment he could have possibly made, even without all those things baked in. But then you bake in everything he did. Like, he was the top senior debt at that point as well. So he couldn't, unless Goldman Sachs did a Lehman Brothers, there was no way Warren Buffett could lose on that bet.
Right. So what's important, I guess, interesting about this is we're basically transitioning from, and it all makes sense now, right? As I've talked to you about, is like in the 60s, a bit younger, managing money for outsiders, friends and family, kind of like, you know, you're young, you're energetic, you're happy to kind of do the trading in and out of these names. Asset base gets bigger as you go into 70s, 80s, and also you're basically an insurance company at this point. Is your investing strategy is going to have to obviously translate from less day trading to more long-term buy and hold, massive high conviction bets. And then you get to your point where financial crisis rolls around. So Buffett's around 80 years old, late 70s, and just his reputation's platinum. And now he gets to structure the deals however he wants. Like this arc that we just described, not very many investors are going to be able to pull that arc off.
Right. Like it's all, and the entire arc is all about more ways to get risk out of the equation.
Yes.
So the first method before he had any kind of name or even a lot of money is buy things simply for less than they're worth. So like you said with Disney, I mean, the theme park alone was worth $80 million. The market cap of the company was worth $80 million. So it's as if you're getting all the future revenues of these amazing movies for free. You're buying that all for free. So that was his total investment style for a long time. Then he throws in like, okay, well, it's not just the assets, but there's some brand value too. So he factors that in. Then he starts thinking, look, I don't like this hedge fund structure because these investors could pull their money out anytime they want. And I only get 20% of the profits. I want 100% of the profits. So he moves to insurance companies where investors can't take, there's no investors. They can't take, the people can't take their money out after they pay insurance unless they get hit by a car or get sick or whatever. And he gets 100% of the profits. So that was another way to remove risk from the equation. And then, you know, things become so big, he can't be nimble. He had to, most of the time, he had to structure these deals where it was just locked tight in his favor. And yep. It's amazing how he gets rid of risk. And I respect it. Like, why should he invest in dot-com companies in the 90s? There was too much risk. Or why should he invest right now in like Bitcoin? Or if he has so much cash, makes no sense for him to buy Bitcoin because it's whether or not he understands it, it's a risk for him. Why take that risk? But you mentioned Druckenmiller though, in your interview with him what was his view on things like Bitcoin or Ethereum?
Oh, he, very negative. He came around to Bitcoin a little bit. So he was looking in 2020, this is how he explained it. He said, I thought Bitcoin, interesting technology, but it was a solution in looking for a problem. And then the government relief hits in around April 2020 in response to COVID. And I think we've printed $7 or $9 trillion since for COVID relief. And he's like, okay. He had come around to the theory that Bitcoin is the hedge for out of control monetary policy. And he got in, I think, at around 12,000 and then sold at 30 and just left the position. He said the reason he sold, he just never had his heart in it. He was convinced to do it by Paul Tudor Jones, also a famous macro trader. And so that was the first reason was he's like, okay, Bitcoin actually has a reason to exist now in his eyes. And then the second reason he gave was Paul Tudor Jones had given him a pretty crazy stat. And the stat was in the end of 2017, when Bitcoin had the drawdown from 20,000 to 3,000 or 4,000 in 2018, after that legendary run, 86% of wallets never sold. So he looked at that. He's like, oh, so these people, called them zealots, they were willing to take 80% drawdowns. He's like, and because they believed in that asset so much, he's like, all right, there's definitely something here. But he ended up selling all of it and said his heart was never in it. And that was his take on Bitcoin.
It's interesting with Buffett, though. There's a book called Super Money by this guy who used a pseudonym. His name was Adam Smith. So it was written by Adam Smith, and the name comes from the guy who in 1776 wrote The Wealth of Nations, which kind of is a book describing what capitalism is. But anyway, this guy took the name Adam Smith, wrote a book called Super Money, and he describes talking to Ben Graham. And this is in 1971. He describes talking to Ben Graham, and Ben Graham says, look, I want you to meet this guy. He's a pretty good investor. He's kind of retired right now. And Adam Smith flies out to where this investor is. The investor meets him. He has a beaten up car. They drive around town. The investor points out to this one furniture store. Oh, one day I'm going to buy that furniture store. But he's like, I don't really know what to do with my life. I have about $20 million, shut down my hedge funds, and now I'm figuring out the next stage of my life. And that investor was Warren Buffett. So it's great to see this book, Super Money, that was written and published in a time well before anyone knew who Warren Buffett was. And that furniture store was the Nebraska Furniture Mart. It's the biggest furniture store in the country. Buffett eventually did buy it. And I don't know if you know the story of this. He bought it from this like 98-year-old woman.
Yes, it's one of his favorite stories to recall, right? It's like a handshake deal, basically.
Yeah. And then she was unhappy with how he was treating the business. So she quit, went across the street, and started a competitor, which started beating out the furniture store. So when she was 100, Buffett bought that business from her and made her sign a non-compete.
That's amazing. That I totally missed the second part of that story.
Yeah. So Buffett's got a lot of interesting stories. And you could argue some of his things are not really, like, he's an old-fashioned kind of investor too. Like, he buys Fruit of the Loom underwear, he buys See's candies. Like, those are now small investments for him, but it's arguable whether they work as well as his current investments. But overall, I would recommend, like, there's various biographies of Buffett that are pretty good. There's one by Roger Lowenstein, which I highly
Snowball?
Recommend. No, not Snowball, by Alice Schroeder, which is still good. But the one by Roger Lowenstein dives a little bit more into his investing. Although Alice Schroeder, who covered Buffett for Goldman Sachs for a long time, that Snowball is very good as well. And he's just such an interesting investor. He really is the best investor ever. And, you know, there was another issue where he got in trouble almost. There was another type of company that had a float, the way insurance companies have float. So again, float is where people give you money and you get to hold on to it, and you don't have to give that money back for maybe
future
forever.
Liabilities, right? The expectations are if there's liability, be way in the future.
So another type of company that has float is companies that sell coupons. So because like, oh, I'll buy $10 for coupons, but I may never use those coupons ever. So potentially the company could hold on to the money forever, and that's the float. And so there was a company called Blue Chip Stamps, which sold coupons, I think, for grocery stores. And Buffett and Charlie Munger were buying up shares of this company. And they even made, I think it was Blue Chip Stamps, they made a deal with the owner that they would never buy the stock for less than a certain price because they wanted her to be treated fairly. And at some point, the stock started trading lower, but they still kept paying the high price. And so the SEC was like, you're manipulating a penny stock here. And Buffett and Charlie Munger had to admit, yeah, we're manipulating a penny stock, but we're paying more for our shares than it costs. And so the SEC said, well, that's illegal, but we're just going to slap you on the wrist. It's no harm, no foul, but you admitted it and it's over. And so he even almost got into a little trouble with that one. But Blue Chip Stamps eventually merged into Buffett's company, and also Charlie Munger's company, Wesco, it merged into. So Charlie Munger had his own Berkshire Hathaway for a long time, which I don't know what ended up happening to that. I lost track of that story.
Well, he's had a couple, to your points. It hasn't just all been free sailing, right? So he had the kind of the insider trading or SEC issue you mentioned. And then in the past decade, Lubrizol, with David Sokol,
one of his top
lieutenants. Also, David Sokol was one of the top lieutenants for Berkshire. I think he was on the operations side. And he basically talked Buffett into buying Lubrizol, which is an industrials manufacturer or industrial parts seller. But basically, Sokol bought shares in Lubrizol and then told Buffett why he should buy it. So it's an insider trading scheme, essentially. It's like if Buffett's going to buy, you know your shares are going to go up. Sokol left Berkshire, and there was an investigation into what Buffett knew and at what time he knew. He argued he had no idea. Other people are a little bit more skeptical, as in you're Buffett, you run Berkshire, right? It's like 12 people running at headquarters. So Lubrizol is a very interesting case that happened in the past decade that's probably worth looking more into for on the governance side.
Yeah, so altogether, like in all your, has looking into Buffett changed you as an investor?
Oh, I'll tell you what, I'm not a good investor. I'm awful. I follow trends. I took a lot of L's during the pandemic, and the one thing I will say that when you say changed is it took a long time for me to come around to. I mean, because stuff he says isn't like you mentioned the 20 punch hole card is like in your life. You basically should just make 20 investments, buy, hold where you can, find good companies. I mean, that advice, the problem in the internet age or 2022 with social media, Finn Twitter, is it's very hard to have the conviction to buy and hold when the dopamine comes from going in and out of trades, right? Like Buffett in the 60s. But the thing that kind of really blew my mind was if you ever pull up a chart over the past 5 years of Berkshire versus Facebook, or Berkshire versus Cathie Wood's ARK Investment Innovation Fund, those Facebook and ARK just rode that wave, right? If you look at the charts, one's going up, 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 up. Berkshire just slow and steady, slow and steady. And then the post-pandemic crash happens, and Berkshire, the Facebook example is the best one. Berkshire overtook Facebook's market cap, even though for a while it was getting dominated by Facebook. And it's just a classic tale of the tortoise winning the race, right? It's just like, they're slow and steady. They've been called dinosaurs by everyone over the past 2-3 decades for not investing in tech. And they're buying old industry, making large acquisitions in railways and in industries and just kind of chugging along. And then they caught Facebook. And that to me is like, oh, there it is. That's a lesson. So like, what I will say is that I do not day trade at all anymore. I just, what I'm holding, I'm holding, and I'm just going to let those equities play out over the next 5-10 years. I don't even look at my portfolio anymore, which is pretty good for, well, good in the sense of like 2020 has been so bad that I don't have to look and be stressed out at how bad it's been. So I would say that's the lesson.
It's very stressful if you look every day.
Yeah. So I say the lesson is that it took me a long time to really internalize that, but that chart of Berkshire versus Facebook, that's all you need to know. It's like, it's slow and steady. It's going to beat the flashy.
So here's a strategy I actually did professionally because of Warren Buffett, which is that I did a statistical study. This is in the early to mid 00s. I did a statistical study of what happens if you buy every Warren Buffett stock after he buys it. So when let's say he buys Apple, then in the next quarterly filing, he has to file something called a 13F filing with the SEC, which displays all of his holdings and you see what his new holdings are. And if you simply piggyback all his holdings, I think I looked at the prior 10 years from 2005, because I did this around 2005, 2006. If you look at the prior 10 years, if you just simply bought every stock Buffett bought, but after he bought it, you would get a 10% more per year than the S&P 500. So in the S&P 500 in general returns 7% per year. So on average, you would return like 17% a year. And so I pitched this to a small bank, and they gave me about $15 million, maybe a little more, to invest with in 2006. And I started doing the strategy, and it did very well. And then
that's amazing.
Yeah. And so the first half of 2006, which was a good half, I did much better than the S&P 500 because I was just in Buffett stocks, and I got paid a good amount of money. And then the second half, the market was falling apart a little bit. So of course, Buffett stocks were going down as well. Maybe not as badly as the S&P, but they were going down, and this bank couldn't handle the volatility. So they said, it's okay, but just stop what you're doing. So I stopped doing it. It was no harm, no foul, but they didn't want to do the strategy anymore. But it is a strategy that has worked. And the way I would diversify it a little is not just use Warren Buffett, but use other long-term holders like Carl Icahn, and there's others.
Ackman, Pershing. I think you could just buy Pershing Square if you really wanted to.
Yeah, Ackman is good. He had some issues with his hedge fund in 2002, 2003. There was a little bit of scandalous stuff, but more recently he's very, you know, on the up and up. Like, he's a very good investor. And there's Dan Loeb, there's Renaissance, there's Millennium. So there's a lot of good investors out there. But Buffett, of course, has always been the best. And then there's also mini Berkshires. So there are some insurance companies that follow the exact same philosophy as Warren Buffett, but they're a little smaller, like White Mountain Insurance, and there's a whole bunch of them. But so if you follow the mini Berkshires, you could also get the same benefits.
Yeah, absolutely. I love that idea, actually, because especially if you think about if his thought is to buy and hold, so even if there's a 3-month lag, it's not like he's making a 3-month thesis, right? He's like, he's making a multi-year thesis. I just wanted to mention one thing before, I don't want to miss it if we went for one wrap, but Buffett said his personal biggest mistake. So this is what he says the biggest mistake is, and this, he said this in the early 90s or mid 90s. So it might've changed since then, but he said Dexter Shoe Company was the biggest investment mistake he made because he used Berkshire stock to acquire the shoe company. At the time of the deal, it was $433 million, which is representative of 1.6% of Berkshire's market cap, which obviously, if you're a shareholder, you're like, Warren, why did you use stock to do this deal? So that's what he says is his worst one.
I wonder why he did use stock there for just a shoe company.
Yeah, I wonder, like,
that was
right?
A weird thing. So, and then, you know, I actually once wrote about another big mistake he had, but it was very, very early on. But I can't find it right now. It was somewhere in my book.
Actually, while you're looking for that, I'll actually import the last paragraph from my newsletter when I wrote on Saturday for SAT Post. Was in reflecting on the Disney deal, he actually makes a great point. So he did say it was a huge mistake to sell in 1966. But he also said that he and Charlie Munger do not care if they sell and the stock goes up after. Like, that doesn't bother them, because all that says to them is that, okay, we bought this company because we thought it was a good business. It's a great business. And if it's running up after we sell it, for whatever reason, sold it, then our thesis that it was a great business is correct, right? And he's like, it's not like you can call the top of every asset. And to him, if you sell a company or a stock and it continues to run, you shouldn't regret it. It's like, if your thesis played out and you actually believe it was good business, then that's just another sign that your thesis was correct.
You know, that's such a great point, actually. And that's a great point, not only for investors, but for entrepreneurs. Like, there are companies I've started where I built them up and sold them, and then after I sold them, they kind of fell apart, or the company that bought them fell apart. And then I wonder, like, oh, was I just lucky? I was in the right place at the right time. I didn't know if I had really made a good business. And there was another time I was invested in a company, and for a long time, I wished I had invested more. And I invested at a $4 million valuation. They sold to Salesforce.com for like almost $900 million about 5 years later. But then Salesforce.com, I believe, wrote the entire amount off. And again, I have to wonder, was I not a good investor because ultimately the company didn't work out? And it's good to know, it's good for your conviction to know that these are still good companies, even if you didn't ride it the full way. I'd much rather, I mean, I was lucky that I did what I did, but I don't like the fact that I had to rely on luck.
Sure. That makes a lot of sense. Like, in your mind, you'd be like, if that thing ran like 10x afterwards, I'd be like, in my mind, I'd be like, oh, at least, I picked a winning horse because it was like on merit and the business model.
Yeah. So, well, once again, Trung Fan, you know, how do you pick what you do for your Twitter threads? You do these great Twitter threads. This came out of a Twitter thread, or a lot of your newsletter comes out of, I don't know. I read this on your newsletter, but I assume it came out of a Twitter thread. How do you come up with your ideas for Twitter threads?
You know, I'll be honest, I'm like you. I just read a ton. I spend a lot of time reading, but something I've let happen more for ideation is I'm kind of let the YouTube algorithm send me places. And I'll give you an example. I knew nothing about art history at all up until a couple months ago. I just had zero interest in it. But I came back from Spain. I saw Gaudi's architecture and I'm like, okay, let me start looking into some of this stuff. And I basically just Googled what I would, I YouTube search what I would normally Google search. So instead of Google searching Gaudi, Sagrada Familia, Barcelona, I did that in YouTube. And the beauty about YouTube is there's so many creators now that are condensing 20, 30 hours of research into 3 to 5 minute videos. So I just let the algorithm take me. And now I have all these interests that I'm writing about, a number of threads about Van Gogh, why is the Mona Lisa so famous?
Will you learn from the content of the YouTube videos, or you take a bunch of videos, or just one video?
No, I'll let the algorithm keep feeding me different ideas that they've decided are relevant and are appealing to other people that like this one piece of content. So that thing about Gaudi sent me down a rabbit hole of Van Gogh, Picasso, Leonardo da Vinci, Michelangelo. I'll send you just through the DM some of these threads I've done recently. I think we should actually talk about a couple of them.
Definitely.
It all started from literally letting the YouTube algorithm take me. And I know people like to talk about how YouTube makes people quote unquote more extreme. There's actually a lot of research that says that's not true. But if you use it correctly, it is such a powerful ideation engine that that's what I'm, to answer your question, that's where currently I'm letting content be fed to me.
What would be the initial search? Like, would you search art history or?
No, so, you know, any search you would do for, so Gaudi, for example, I literally was just in Barcelona and I just, on Google, if I wanted to learn about Gaudi, I'd just write Gaudi Barcelona, right? I literally just do that in YouTube now. And they surface the most concise, most watched video of that class. And then they start feeding me related videos. And that's how I'm learning about, because I wouldn't even know where else to search. I don't want to flip through a book. I want to do it super quickly and get the visuals because art history is very specific. It's not enough to just to read about it. You want to see the visuals, and YouTube is just perfect for that.
That's brilliant. I'm gonna definitely try this.
Yeah, just start. Like, start your Google searches on YouTube. You'll be very surprised at what will happen. Like, content's just as good. It's getting just as good in video format.
Excellent. Well, Trung Phan, once again, thank you so much. Buffett is obviously one of my favorite topics as an investor and as someone who, I mean, I've been so fascinated by him. I even wrote a book about him, the least read book about him ever. And thanks once again for coming on the show, third time. I'm looking forward to time number four. We're going to talk about art history.
Yeah, this is amazing. Thank you so much. This is a great time.
Thanks, Trung.